Thank you for the introduction. Good afternoon. I guess everything I was going to say about this slide has already been said, so I'll move on to the next one. So just a brief outline. I'll give a introduction. We'll talk a bit about the data we have. It's lightning and fire data from the Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources. We'll talk a bit about our initial explorations of this data and some of the difficulties that arose. Then we're going to talk about what we hope will be a way to deal with one of these difficulties, which is what we'll call identifying lightning cluster centers, and this is using a method called data sharpening. Another application of this data sharpening method is how we can track these storms, and I guess there's an automatic timer on this or something. And then I'll have some conclusions. So on to the introduction. Lightning causes 35 to 40% of the forest fires in Canada, and it accounts for approximately 80% of the burned area. The ultimate goal of our study would be a probability mapping of lightning-caused forest fire incidents, and our current goal is just exploring our data. The types of questions we're asking are what statistical tools might be useful, as well as what issues arise when we start to look at this data. So a bit about the lightning data and how it's gathered. This is Ontario lightning data, and there's 16 direction finders in Ontario. These direction finders record only cloud-to-ground discharges, which is good because there's four types of lightning. Lightning can occur from ground to cloud, within a cloud, from cloud to cloud, or also from cloud to ground. And since we're interested in lightning-ignited fires, we're interested in the cloud-to-ground discharges. Types of variables that this data has is there's time, location in terms of latitude and longitude, the polarity, which, as Mike Watton already alluded to, positive polarity may play a role in lightning-caused fires because positive polarity strokes are associated with that long continuous current, and there's signal strength, and for some years we have multiplicity as well. This lightning detection system uses a triangulation method to detect the discharges, and unfortunately, detection efficiency is only about 70%. So that is, given that a strike occurred, the probability it will be detected is only 70%, and location errors can be as large as 10 kilometers. Part of the reason there's location errors is if a lightning strike occurs, well, there's these detectors in Ontario, and if a lightning strike occurs, it sends out some sort of electrical wave. I'm not sure exactly what electrical wave it is. And basically, these detectors are picking up that wave, and then the location is given as the centroid of that rhombus-looking thing there. So that's where we run into location error difficulty. And of course, since the way these detection system works, this accuracy depends on how close the lightning strike occurs in relation to these direction finders. Another thing to note is strokes with long continuous current cannot be identified. We also have fire ignition data. It gives locations again in terms of longitude and latitude. It gives start times, out times, and the final area burned. We have some weather data that eventually we'd like to be incorporating into our modeling, and we also have, this also includes the relative types of indices such as the Duff Moisture Code, the FWI, and so on. So lightning caused fires are caused by long continuous current strokes. Anderson in 2002 in the International Journal of Wildland Fire gave the following formula for the conditional probability of a lightning-caused fire at time t, given a lightning flash at what would be time zero. So the probability of a fire at time t is a function of four things. It's the probability of that stroke having a long continuous current, the probability of ignition, times the probability of survival, or you could think of this as the smoldering that's going on, most likely in the Duff layer, and then of course, the fire has to, in fact, ignite or arrive. And this T could represent several days of smoldering within the dust layer. And part of this analysis is we're hoping this leads to how we can estimate this survival. I'm not sure if I'm using the correct notation. Is it smoldering time or holdover time we're trying to estimate? Dr. Holdover time? Okay, yeah. So we're trying to estimate the holdover time. Some initial explorations. Again, we have Ontario lightning and fire data from 1980 onwards. And Roger Peng in 2001 stated that confronted with this type of data, the statistician struggles. If we look at 1994 as kind of a test bed, and we do the first rule of data analysis, which is plot the data, it becomes evident what's going on. A lot of the previous plots, people have put the outline of the map of the location of interest. We don't need to bother doing that here, because as you can see, Ontario kind of gets hit by a lot of lightning strikes. This is only May, where the lightning activity is just starting to pick up. And the red dots, there's 14 of them. These represent the fire locations in May. So from this plot, we have a few things to note. Obviously, the lightning data is large. If we look at another month in 1994, July, for example, there were about 160,000 strikes. So you see, this is why we're told not to stand outside during the thunderstorms. The other thing about the fires is some of them appear in clusters. There's none in southern Ontario. And these lightning clusters are not readily visible from our plot. And in fact, in summer months, they're not visible at all. If we do go down to a smaller time window, you can start to see the more clustering effect of these lightning strikes or as a potential storm within a small time window. And we'll see one of those shortly. And one of the difficulties of this is, this presents is it's difficult to establish a not only linear, but just an association in general between lightning and fires. Another question is, are there missing data? This is more to deal with the fire ignitions. These fire ignitions are classified as to whether a lightning strike occurred within 10 kilometers. What we're going to do is we're going to classify the fire ignitions we have. And these, according to the data, these are lightning-caused fires we're talking about. So what we're going to do is, in the next plot, we're going to classify them according to whether a lightning strike occurred within 10 kilometers. That's to try and account for the location error of the detection system. And we're also going to check whether it occurred in the last 12 days or not to try and account for any holdover or smoldering. And again, smoldering can last for more than 10 days. That was Flanagan and Watton in 1990. So this is a plot of lightning-caused fires in Ontario, 1994. The red circles represent lightning-caused fires that we were able to locate a lightning strike within a 10-kilometer radius and within the previous 12 days. And the black dots, most of them are occurring in northern Ontario, with the one in the southeastern region, are ones that did not have that. So what we thought we might want to try and do is to deal with the missing lightning data is, rather than looking at each individual strike, look at strikes as a storm or a cluster of strikes coming through. And to do that, we're going to look at something called data sharpening, which was introduced by Choi and Hall in 1999. The original motivation for this was to reduce bias and density estimation. When you do any sort of smoothing or density estimation, the peak of the density is underestimated, and this hopefully alleviates that. Well, they actually showed that it does reduce the bias. So again, our assumptions are we have raw data with some unknown distribution f of x. We want to estimate that, and we can estimate it according to this function f hat of x, which is just smoothing based on, it's kernel smoothing, where h is our bandwidth. So the kernel function can be just any symmetric PDF, usually a Gaussian, and we actually use one with compact support. To obtain the sharpened data, all we're actually doing is just regressing the covariates on themselves. We're regressing X on itself. So rather than regressing Y on X or our response, as we'd normally do in regression, we're now just regressing the data on itself. And basically, this is similar to our SXY over SXX type formula in regression. And this leads to the following density estimate. And again, this reduces the bias and density estimation. But why is that important to us? Well, it's reducing the bias about the local modes. It's actually just shifting the data in a way closer towards the local modes. And what is interesting about this is we can iterate this procedure. We can sharpen the sharpened data. And in fact, this identical procedure was identified earlier in a paper by Fukunaga and Hostetler, and I think they called it something about moving data uphill, because they're talking about just the gradient of the data. And if we look at a two-dimensional example, the following plot is just a scatter plot of a mixture of two normal distributions, one with the mean of 0, one with the mean of 3, and we can go through this iteration. So again, here's the data. Obviously, it's fairly clear that we have two clusters, one centered around 0,0, one centered around 3,3. Sharpening the data once reveals these red points. We can see that the data has started to move in towards the clusters from the outside. And if we keep sharpening, so the next plot, we're going to sharpen the red points on themselves. And if we do so, we can see how things start to converge. And eventually, we pick out the two modes of 0,0 and 3,3. So why is that important? Well, lightning, we have the longitude and latitude, but the lightning strikes are occurring through time. And what's good about this data sharpening is you can sharpen in any number of directions. And you can also vary the bandwidth between the orthogonal dimensions. So again, sorry, this iteration converges. It's applicable in any number of dimensions. And what we want to do is we want to use it as a data reduction strategy. So given all our lightning strikes, we want to sharpen the data in space-time to identify these storm centers of lightning activity. For a bandwidth, what we did for space was 1 degree, which is approximately 100 kilometers. And for the time bandwidth, we dealt with about 1 day. These were basically playing around with the data, looking at the plots, and seeing what appeared to give nice results. We haven't gone into verifying these are the absolute correct choice or anything like that. So here's a 3D scatter plot of about 2,000 strikes in 1992. Latitude and longitude are the X and Y coordinates, and time is on the Z scale. The time units might look a bit interesting. That's basically because time, as we're expressing it now, is we've changed our month, day, year, time, month, day, year, hour, time, into just the number of days since 1963, because that's how far back we can go with the data. So we can see here that the lightning is appearing in clusters. So over this region, we had clusters occurring, lightning strikes occurring here in time, again, and so on in time. So we can iterate our sharpening. Well, we can sharpen this data on itself. And again, an iterative procedure, we can start to pick out the cluster centers. So that's after one iteration. We can basically see that we've already started to move. And again, the other thing to note is this algorithm, if there's a single strike or a small number of strikes isolated by itself in space and time, it is picked out as a sharpened center as well. So after two iterations, three, and then again 10 iterations, so we can see we have about seven to nine cluster centers as we're talking about. Yes. Okay, the question was, what is the length of time? And we're looking at approximately 84... it would be a matter of a few days, I would think. Well, I'm going backwards, aren't I? So again, we've picked out these cluster centers. Now we can produce the same sort of plot again, trying to plot, these are again the lightning ignited fires, but now we're trying to classify them according to whether they had a close storm center. And our definition of close has changed a bit here. We're still talking within a storm center within the last 12 days, but obviously we can't use a space radius of 10 kilometers, so we've moved to 1 degree, which is approximately 100 kilometers. No, I'm wrong about that. I said that wrong, didn't I? We used 100 kilometers as our bandwidth for space, and now we're classifying whether the fires had a close storm center pass by. And by close, it's the same definition. It's within 10 kilometers in the last 12 days. So you can see that previously we had 3 or 4 lightning-caused fires in this region that didn't have any lightning strikes associated with it. And now there's only 4 left. And I think if we were to maybe, in discussions with Mike Watton, if we were to maybe go back a little bit further in time, maybe a couple more days, it'd be interesting to see whether these ones disappeared or not. This plot is just kind of an illustrative plot of the close storm centers and fires in Ontario in 1994. The fires are given by red triangles, the close storm centers are identified by black circles, and the blue squares just show typical district locations. And we can see this is kind of a bit messy, so we'll zoom in on this part around Dryden and Kenora, and we have the following plot. So we're in the Dryden-Kenora-Fort Francis district, and we notice that, for example, Here's several fires. There's 5 fires there with only 1 close storm center associated with it. And in some cases, a fire such as this one might have 3 close storm centers associated with it. And some other things to note is there's a boundary effect we have to worry about here because we're only dealing with Ontario data. And it doesn't record any strikes over lakes or across borders. So sharpening automatically moves all the strikes here in towards the interior. So another thing or another application of this data sharpening is tracking storms through time. This was identified as a filtering technique by Fukunaga and Hostetler. And basically what we want to do is we want to reduce the noise in the data. And what's interesting about this is we can reduce the noise in whatever dimension we want. And we want to reduce the noise in the latitude, longitude, or the spatial dimension. And we can use this to kind of reveal our dominant data surface or where these storm centers tracked along over time. Why is that? Well, storm systems move across Ontario. And basically, if we reduce the time bandwidth and don't iterate to convergence, we can track the path of our storm center. So here's a sample storm system. This is 4 days in 1997. And again, you can see there were lots of strikes all over Ontario. This storm center was picked out by just looking at small samples of lightning strike times and then just picking out a period that seemed to be isolated in terms of time. So if we do 2 iterations of the data sharpening again with a spatial bandwidth of 1 degree, but now using a time bandwidth of a half day, we can start to pick out kind of the track that the storm seemed to take. And we could, I also tried using a temporal bandwidth of 1/4 of a day, and that revealed the following track. So again, there's boundary issues here, especially in southwestern Ontario. Pretty well every track I tried to produce has this type of pattern, but that's because we're dealing with a triangular area there. So to conclude, I guess there's no worrying about time for me. We have some data issues, right? In order to try and link lightning to fires, we have to look at our data, and we needed to summarize or reduce our large lightning observations. And we also have to deal with the missing and inaccurate data. Another question that's come up is, again, non-stationarity. Ontario is relatively big, and we've done some investigative looking into intensity, cross-intensity between these storm centers and fire ignitions. And when we look at different districts, we're not getting an identical thing there. Tools, we have the converged data sharpening to identify cluster centers as well as do the tracking. And we have, with these cluster centers, we can locate the close fire ignitions. So again, I'm a PhD student. There's lots of further work. I'm going to have to pick a topic and start to go with it one of these days. But we have questions like, can we model lightning as a Poisson cluster process? If we do this, can we use these sharpened storm centers to study these clusters? This converged data sharpening depends on those bandwidth, those time and space bandwidth parameters. Trying to quantify our choices for those is another question. We're looking at smoldering time, or I guess holdover time. A possible application here would be the point process cross-intensity function. Again, I've talked about non-stationarity, as well as, obviously, there's more than just lightning that contributes to lightning-caused fires. There's other weather variables, our fuel moisture codes, and so on. And also, there's other stuff we've talked about in terms of the lattice growth models, spot fires, containment, as well as there's simple questions that forest managers would be interested in terms of optimal resource allocation. I guess another thing to note is we've done some preliminary just regression modeling similarly to what was talked about yesterday, regressing, trying to identify fires. And lightning last week and 2 weeks ago is a significant covariate, as well as some of the fuel moisture codes and so on. So that's good news. We'd like to thank ENSER. We'd also like to thank Dave Martell for conversations we've had with him over the past. And I guess that's it. Thank you for your time. Sure. Yes.
What does the theory say has to be true about the air generating process in order for the convergence to decide a particular instance for a cluster?
Well, one thing for sure is bandwidth is an issue. If we used a kernel such as a Gaussian with infinite support, we don't get local modes. We get the overall mode. And so we did use a kernel with a compact support so that once you're outside of that bandwidth, it identifies, it separates it out. So did that kind of answer your question? Is that okay?
I guess so, yeah.
Okay. Dr. Brown, feel free to jump in if I'm saying anything horribly wrong. Okay.
With the actual fire curtains itself. And very naive cluster building, I'm sure you seen on paper. Very naive cluster process using daily fire counts, daily fire occurrences. Because these things didn't appear to be associated with storm. It might be a way of testing or coming out from the other direction, clustering the fires.
Cluster the fires and then compare them to the storm tracks or the lightning clusters.
I'm sure that Mike Watton must have mentioned the radar data that does exist in some times and places where they actually know the location of storm tracks.
No, I didn't know about that.
Right. Mike Watton told me about that, but there's some such data that's not there.
Yeah, we collected some for a couple of years.
Okay.
Thinking of it as a validation check.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, for sure. Yes. Okay. That's a good suggestion. Yeah, we do have some rain data across the different districts that shows the amount of precipitation. So, yes, thank you.
According to that clustering process I mentioned, seems to show and identify features that could be interpreted.
The fire clustering process? Sorry, okay.
Yeah, the fire clustering process identified features that did seem like they might be storm tracks if you squinted. And oddly enough, the fire occurrences were sort of what you expect,
and effectively
is
perimeter precipitation
to
the sure. Dr. Martel. Yes. What's interesting in looking at the strikes individually too is you don't see, like, there's kind of an oscillation over local areas. Like, we're not seeing the strikes happen here and then keep moving along. You'll see some strikes here and then the next strikes in time are occurring at a different location. But we kind of hypothesized that makes sense because you have a buildup at one part of the storm system and then a discharge, right? And then so another buildup might be happening somewhere else, like, because the storm systems obviously are quite large. Yes. Yeah, I've never plotted the tracking through the 3D. Yeah, that's a good idea. Thank you. Mike. It might be. But see what... Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering if
Well, see, I wondered about that, but at the same sense, in looking at different sets of data, like, for example, in some cases you might see a track going this way, right? Which kind of, in that was just my rough way of quantifying, okay, we're not just tracing out Ontario around the boundaries, right? And same with here, right? We could have had something like that. But I think obviously boundary effect with this type of method is an issue. That's a quarter of a day, so.
I'm just curious, why would you do this sharpening with respect to time?
Well, we're trying to track how the storm system moved according to time. Like, we're basically trying to remove all the noise in the spatial direction, and we're just projecting the time path on this two-dimensional plot. Yeah. No, if we
what you're typically see, I think, I mean, that's what you were talking about, generally storms in Ontario, they go northwest or they go southwest
Oh, that's good. I like my plot more now. There was the economics guy had a question.
I was just curious,
Okay. Yes, you would, especially if it was the space bandwidth.
Right. So
how do I choose it? That plot I showed that was the fires and the close storm centers, just playing around with things and seeing, okay, well, this one starts to look good. Like, there's nothing quantitative behind it yet. It's just when I produce a plot like that, the fires themselves, all of them have something close to them, like a close storm center, save for those missing ones that we had up here still. So it was just quantitative. Same with the daily bandwidth. The daily bandwidth seemed to work quite, like, seems intuitively, it seems that it's a good choice for a time bandwidth, just because you have the storm centers, you know, you don't have 24 hours of intense storm. Even if you have right now, yes. There's, yep. The time interval, this is, I believe it's 4 days. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Like this storm was picked out again in a qualitative type of way, just looking at histograms of lightning strikes, certain at lightning strike times with a very, very small bin width. We'd have, like, you'd look at your histogram and you'd have stuff like this, right? So I was just basically saying, again, they should be boxes, right? But I was saying something like this, okay, that's going to be my hypothetical storm or storm system, because it was a group of strikes isolated in time. That's how this was picked out. But I know exactly what you're saying. Like, there's most likely more than one storm moving through here, for sure, I would think. Yeah, we have, like, how related to a storm front movement would be the wind data? Like, is the storm kind of producing the wind, or would there be a high correlation there? Okay. Okay. And I'd like to thank all you guys for all your input, and I'm kind of glad I finished early now. So, thanks. I can't just finish early when I have to defend stuff.
Thank you, Charmaine. Is it on? I think it's still on. It's got the light on. Is that better? Okay. So as Charmaine has said, I've made a move, and so one of the things that you want to think about,